WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tom Hanks. He's the executive producer of the new HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon, which dramatizes the history of the Apollo space program. We're going to talk about several of Hanks' movies, including Apollo 13, which led him to make the new miniseries. What impact did it have on you to play Jim Lovell in Apollo 13? And did you get to meet him and find out what impact it had on him for you to have told his story?
Well, you know, it was actually, I was very afraid of my countenance being used in order to be portraying an astronaut, because I was, oddly enough, I had swallowed the myth, hook, line, and sinker, of, you know, the iron-jawed, steely-eyed, you know, throttle jockey aspect that has really been spoon-fed to us as though we get our sense of history from the from Wheaties boxes. And by meeting Jim and realizing that on first glance you would assume that Jim is a successful dentist or a well-read insurance agent. He's not a tall man, you know. He's not a muscular man. He's not a scary man. He's not an intimidating man. He is just this really great guy who, you find out, has made 100 night landings on an aircraft carrier in the Sea of Japan. And, by the way, was one of the first three men to leave the Earth's gravitational pull, orbit the moon, and come back, and was also the commander of Apollo 13. To realize that these guys who were literally interplanetary explorers, or the closest thing we have to interplanetary explorers, are not all that different from you or I, that indeed somebody who has my countenance and my outlook and the same attitude when he gets out of bed could indeed be someone who leaves the planet Earth. That was something of an eye-opening catharsis for me, and made me feel as though, you know what, I'm the perfect guy to play Jim Lovell. At first I thought I was as far removed, but after meeting him and getting to know him and hanging around him, I realized that if you're going to cast somebody to play Jim Lovell, you better come and get me.
What did you learn as an actor about what it's like to be in the spacesuit and to be in the capsule and so on? Or to perform in the role of an astronaut who's not a particularly demonstratively emotional person, that you were able to pass on to the actors you worked with?
Well, you know, it was really the concept of, look, you guys, I was always saying, look, you guys know this stuff back and forth. You know this. You know what it is that you're talking about when you're flicking these switches. So don't arbitrarily flick switches. Don't simply go click, 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 zip, 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 zip. Because you know what? You don't do that. You've been sitting there. You've covered this. You've rehearsed this 100 million times in drills and tests and full up simulations. You've been in the simulator for thousands upon thousands of hours recreating this stuff. So don't do anything arbitrarily. Act as though you know this stuff backwards and forwards, because they did. These guys, you know, you can still ask them about moments on the flight plan, and they can rattle off, you know, 9 different things that they had to do. Well, let me tell you, Tom, you know, the problem with that glycol pump is often that suddenly I'm lost and get in this guy's reverie of what it meant to stir their cryo tanks. But that was the idea that they were incredibly accomplished human beings. It was as though, like, look, imagine you're playing a concert violinist. If you're playing a concert violinist, you're not going to be intrigued by these things that intrigue you about being a concert violinist, because you've done it 100 million times. So just sit there and play the violin like you've known this piece of music for 100 million years.
You directed the first episode in this new From the Earth to the Moon series. What's the best direction you've ever had in a movie that you weren't directing but you were acting in?
Oh, do it different. That was it. It was literally just do that different. You get to the point where you're an actor and you think that what your job is to sit at home the night before and say, okay, here's how I'm going to do this. Here's how I'm going to say this line. And when this moment comes, I'm going to turn. I'm going to give this look. And what that look is going to communicate is everything that I want communicated in the scene. And that's what I'm going to do. And you think that that's what your job is. Well, you know, your job is to get there and tell the truth according to the dictates of the scene. Spencer Tracy said this. He said, the actor's job is to hit the marks and tell the truth. You have to be in the reality of that very specific moment. And there are times that, I mean, this was very, you know what, I'll tell you. It was in a TV movie I did called Rona Jaffe's Mazes and Monsters. And the director said to me, you know, that was great. That was fine. That was okay. Do it different. And I thought, well, do it different. My God, man. I've done all this preparation for this. This is what you don't understand. I'm an artist. But in a moment, a light went off in my head, a great illumination, I might add, that said, oh, I see what he's saying.
And what was he saying?
He's saying that was fake and that was baloney. And that's what you want us to believe is going on. But you know what? We can see that you've just made these arbitrary choices in order to make it seem as though you're undergoing something. And in fact, I'm not believing it. So please do something different. And that demands a lot of things. That demands a certain fluidity and a certain, as well as a trusting of the text itself, as opposed to your sole interpretation of what that text is.
So when you as a director have to tell an actor to do it different, is those the words that you'd use, or is there a nice or a not nice way of putting that?
There's other ways of doing it. Hopefully you've had enough communication with your actors prior to that, so you sort of speak the same language. And I must say, I'm perfectly willing to take that kind of blatant direction from guys. But there's ways of doing it. So you can come and say, you know what, this Nora Ephron does this a lot. I'm making a movie with her right now. Nora always comes up
She wrote Sleepless in Seattle.
And directed it. And she says, you know what this moment is? This is the moment where you know that you're doing the right thing, but in fact you're not doing the right thing. And there's an infinite possibilities of what she means there, and I think I do understand what she means. And so you end up going off down this road, and that is essentially a very cool way and a very polite way of saying, do something different. Because who knows, when they put this movie together 6 months from now, that one thing that you are providing and recreating over and over again may not be the thing that's going to make the scene. And so you have to trust the fact that there is a degree of serendipity that goes into your performance on any given day that can make or break that scene and therefore the whole enterprise.
When you started acting, did you ever practice in front of a mirror so you could actually watch what you were doing and see what the effect was?
No. There was a time I worked with videotape cameras, but I found that was such a narcissistic way of doing it. I was just falling into even greater traps. As an actor, I must say, I'd be damned if I could tell you what my process is, because I don't ever want to think about it, because then I'd probably start paying too much attention to a process that I've written down as opposed to some instinctual push towards preparing for the role. But the thing that I do more than anything else is I just read the text over and over and over again. Because every time you read it, you see something new, and every time you read it, you find out something that you missed the first time, and you realize that there's something that somebody else is saying is much more important to the thing than what you are saying. And so that by the time I show up on the set, I'm so familiar with the text that I can go any way the director would like me to go, and I'll feel confident in getting there.
My guest is Tom Hanks. He's the executive producer of the new HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon, which begins Sunday. We'll talk more about his movies after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tom Hanks. You wrote, directed, and co-starred in the film That Thing You Do a couple of years ago, which was set in the same era as your space series. It was set in 1964.
Those go-go 60s.
About a small-town rock band that becomes a one-hit wonder. And I guess I'm wondering if those two themes are connected in your mind, this one-hit wonder rock band of the 60s and the moon flights.
Well, I have to tell you that I'm 41 years old, and I have a degree of the disease that everybody else my age has.
That my era is the most important era.
Well, you know what? Yes, exactly right. The people who are 10 years older than us think differently, and the people who are 10 years younger than us think differently as well. I must say, I look back on those. We were just talking about when I was 9 years old. I could probably remember moments when I was 9 years old better than I can remember moments from when I was 39 years old, because they were so indelible. And all I can remember is the Beatles were so cool, and there was nothing more magical than the Ed Sullivan Show when the Beatles were going to be on it. And I remember distinctly walking across that playground in Mrs. Castle's class to sit in the auditorium to watch a Jiminy capsule sit on top of an Atlas booster and go nowhere for hours on end. I'm not a great filmmaker. I'm not a great storyteller. I'm some guy who works in the movies. But you know what? When it comes down to the stuff that I really do have a passion for, and I think I can recreate on paper, it all always, it's going to come out of my own experience somehow, especially right now. And these things that are so powerful for me are truly, I can tell you, the big three from my life are the Beatles, and it is the Apollo space program, and it is Vietnam. I still ponder all three of those things over and over again. Well, I read them as hobbies.
It's interesting that you mentioned Vietnam, because I think for a lot of people during the Vietnam War, the space program had a sense almost of irrelevance or of misplaced values. You know, we're fighting this war, we're killing people in another country, there's poverty in our own neighborhoods, and yet we're sending men to the moon. I mean, some people were really quite outraged about that. How did you reconcile that?
Well, we just pay homage to the fact that they were going on hand in hand.
Right.
We are our fourth episode, which is entitled 1968, which is about the Apollo 8 mission, really chronicles month by month everything that went on in that year, starting in January and ending in December. The cruel twist of fate in regards to the Apollo moon program is that it did happen as a bookend to Vietnam in tandem. And here was this thing that was siphoning off so much of our attention, so much of our grief, and so much of our money to a tragic and oppressive end, really. I mean, there was no escaping Vietnam at the time. Well, and on the other side of it, here was this altruistic thing that was expanding the horizons of humankind that was also costing an awful lot of money.
Were you of draft age during the war?
No, I was not.
You know what I find interesting in a way? You know, at the same time that we have the Apollo missions, it's the period that your movie That Thing You Do is set, and it's such a lo-fi period. I mean, people are still selling like hi-fis and appliance stores along with refrigerators, and you know, we have like, you know, yeah, wax records that break and scratch, and you know,
yeah, this needle that goes around in a groove.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, it literally rubs in a groove, and that's how you hear the music.
I mean, the space accomplishments of the 60s still seem just absolutely spellbinding and fantastic, whereas the audio quality of the 60s doesn't seem very good.
Well, there's something to be said for that good quality mono recording. Yeah. There's something about that fine Phil Spector wall of sound that has a unique distinctive territory.
You know, years ago, if somebody would have been making the rock movie of yours set in the 60s, you would have been one of the young rock musicians. But of course, you, as an older actor, comparatively older actor, played the agent. At what point did you realize that you weren't going to be boyish anymore in movies?
I could tell you it was just prior to doing a movie with Penny Marshall called League of Their Own. I found, you know, I had
that was a women's league baseball movie.
Yes. I had a career and was actually relatively lucrative of playing, you know, guys who seemed to be suffering from the Peter Pan syndrome for most of their lives. You know, guys who, you know, are looking for, you know, the good relationship with a woman, and there was an awful lot of that. And I just reached a saturation point where I sat down with my crack team of show business experts, on both of them, and said, you know what, I think I'm done doing that. I want to play men who have histories, men who are dealing with other aspects of their humanity, rather than Jeepers Creepers, I don't have a girlfriend, to that effect. I mean, I made a movie called Big in 1988, which was probably like the epitome of the boyishness that I bring to a role, and after that, I honestly felt done. I felt as though I can't go back and examine this stuff anymore. I'm not against being charming in a movie. I'll try to dredge that up. But as far as being boyish, I just can't do it anymore.
Where did you find the right body language and voice for Forrest Gump? Where did you look in yourself for that?
Well, the first thing that I understood about Forrest when it began was that he couldn't operate faster than his own common sense. That's the one thing that I got from reading it. That's the one thing I presented to Bob Zemeckis and Eric Roth, who wrote it. I said, look, I don't know anything about this guy except he can't operate faster than his own common sense. So that automatically made him, quote unquote, slow or hesitant, and not very verbal. Everything else, I must say, came through this long period of bad experimentation on my part of trying to find this guy. And it didn't honestly click in until the young actor who played the young Forrest and I met. And we did some camera tests, screen tests here in Los Angeles about maybe a month or 2 months prior to beginning of shooting. I just said, Lord, this kid is perfect. And I had a brief conversation with Bob. I said, look, don't have this kid change anything. Don't make him do anything that I have ideas. That's going to be virtually impossible. Let me just take him. He was a fascinating kid. He was a good kid. And he had this distinctive way of talking that I was following him around with a tape recorder and then sat down with the dialogue coach, a woman by the name of Jessica Drake. And I said, okay, how do we make this an organic thing that comes out of my mouth? And what we did in the 2 weeks prior to beginning the shooting was we slowly read the entire screenplay out loud. I read it to her. Every page number, every exterior, Forrest Gump's house. It is a sunny day on the river, and Forrest is mowing the lawn. You know, and I said everybody's dialogue. I said every fade in. I said every fade out. I said every cut to. And it took a real long time. But by the time we were done, it was locked in my head enough so that I could put on the clothes and go out and be Forrest.
Right. I'm curious about the ideas that you rejected.
They were pretty bad. You know, it's like bad Southern accents. And this is I must say that this is a really. You talk about how you prepare to do this, and you have to fail horribly before you can figure any of this stuff out. You really have to be bad. And you have to trust that badness is like being on a river, and you're floating downstream even though you don't realize it, and you're going to get there, but you have to go up these tributaries that are really quite ugly and terrible and embarrassing. And I could probably play you some audio tapes of early passes we made at the voiceover of Forrest Gump. And it's just god-awful. But we knew it was god-awful when we were doing it. I experienced it in some ways as well when I was doing a movie called Punchline. And I had to get up and do stand-up comedy in clubs, and I had no act. But it's a terrible feeling to get up on stage and bomb. But I knew that I had to get up on stage and bomb before I could get up on stage and be any good. And that was the only way of getting into the getting the research done and getting the material for the character. And so you sort of have to, like, put all of your self-consciousness aside and say, I'm really going to be terrible for about 6 weeks. And hopefully at the end of 6 weeks, we'll actually be on the right track.
Now, I have to ask you, the movie In and Out seemed to be a kind of what-if movie that took off from your Academy Award acceptance for the movie Philadelphia, in which you thanked a teacher who was gay as being the inspiration.
The best reviews of my career. The best reviews of my career in In-N-Out. I'm not even in the movie. I was mentioned in the first paragraph of every single review.
Right.
And I didn't get a dime.
So you didn't really out your teacher, though, did you?
No, I did not. No, I think one of a tabloid said I did, and it was far from the truth.
And what was his reaction to your...
Well, this is my drama teacher in high school, Raleigh T. Farnsworth, and I had called him about a week prior to the Academy Awards, and I hadn't seen him, I hadn't spoken to him since, I actually kept in contact with him a little bit after I graduated from high school, but honestly, it's been 20 some odd years. But I called him on the phone, tracked him down, and said, Mr. Farnsworth? Tom Hanks here. And he said, well, hello, how are you? And I said, well, I'm fine. And I explained, he knew that I was nominated, and he thought I might. Well, he said, well, I think you're going to win. And I said, well, if I do, is it all right if I mention your name and if I mention that you're gay and that I'm able to say thank you for it? Because I think it's obviously part and parcel to the reason that I'm there. And he said, well, I think it'd be wonderful. And so I did. So I did ask him if it would be all right. And he was a very proud man, and I was very proud to do it.
Tom Hanks. He's now the executive producer of the new HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon, which begins Sunday. This is Fresh Air.